Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Tim, and this is Get On Board,
a podcast about games worth playing.
This podcast topic is games that we are calling High Floor, Low Ceiling. So, Andrew, why don't you explain to us what a high floor, low ceiling game is?
Alrighty. Well, this is actually, I cribbed this from a baseball term for a prospect that doesn't have a big chance of making it in the big leagues. That's a pretty negative assessment, but we're not necessarily coming down hard on these games. These are just games that have a high floor, which means they will always be interesting, but a low ceiling, which means it's not likely that these will ever be your favorite games, if that makes sense. So these are mostly accessible games, games that you can bring out with any audience and be pretty confident that you're going to have a good experience with them.
So the high floor is about the game's fun level and not the game's like skill level or difficulty, right?
Right.
So we're not saying that the game is a high floor and that it's difficult to learn. In fact, we're saying the opposite.
Right.
We're saying the game is relatively easy to learn, gives gamers a really sort of fun, quick experience. It's easy to pull out with a group, but in the end, they don't create like super incredible great experiences, but they still hit the table a lot.
Right.
Because they're just good, accessible games.
I like to call them reliable games also. They're the ones that I count on when I don't know who's showing up to game night.
All right. So we're doing today. Today is a pick five. And for us here at Get On Board, a pick five is not ranked. It's just five games that we pick out of the blue. We could do another pick five on this topic 2 months from now, and some of these games might be the same. Some of them might be different. So these aren't in any particular order. And, oh, yeah, do you want to introduce a little rule that we thought of, too, about what happens if we have overlap on this list?
Right. So we've actually both come up with six or seven games. We're basically making sure that we are going to be recommending 10 unique games. So if either of us mentions a game on our five that the other person already thought of, we have some fallback games to fall back on so that we can be sure to give you 10 unique games because, I don't know, this is a category that you could have lots of these in your collection.
But there might be a problem with the math if we have five overlapping games.
That's true. I don't think that's likely.
I don't think it's very likely.
I think I have five that you will not overlap with. I'm nearly positive.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Kick it off. What is your, not number one, what is just the first in sequence of your pick five?
Okay, well, the first game that I want to feature is kind of an obscure game. It is called Kuhhandel Master, or translated from the original Dutch, Cow Handling Master. This riveting game will have you trading pedigrees for various animals and trying to earn the most points. Now, the theme really doesn't sell it. It has cartoony artwork. But there's a re-theme available on BoardGameGeek that kind of redoes everything in a samurai theme. And that's more interesting for what's essentially an abstract game. But I really want to give this one some airtime because it's just really interesting. So basically, you're trying to get complete sets of four cards, and those will be worth points multiplied by how many sets of four you got. So maybe I collect the 65 set and the 15 set, which is 80 points times two complete sets, which I completed, which makes for a total score of 160. So it's a little bit mathy, but it's not difficult. And in my experience, it's very high on negotiations and arguments, two of my favorite things in gaming. So this, honestly, this might even be a high ceiling game for me. I've really enjoyed it when we've played it.
I've enjoyed this one a lot too, and I'd give you some grief about picking some obscure out of print thing, but boy, this thing is really, really good. Though that topic is just cheesy.
It is.
The topic and the art.
But, it is.
But what's really cool, if we may linger on this game just a little bit more.
Sure.
Describe like the choice that you have on your turn. And how, just pick like one of those bidding mechanics to describe, because that's the meat of this game.
Right. So on your turn, you will be the auctioneer. And you're going to draw two cards from the top of the deck, and depending on the type of card, you are going to call a different type of auction. So there's one auction that's just an open auction, and you bid your money cards, which, by the way, are exact change only. You may also have a countdown auction, where you count down, and the number of cards that someone bids is what carries the day. Or you may even have a no-thanks style kind of pass the buck auction where you have to throw a money card on the card to not take it. These are bad cards.
Yeah.
And then eventually someone just grabs all the money. But the twist that sells this game for me, and I know I'm rambling on it a bit, as the auctioneer, you always have the choice
yep.
to accept the winning bid from the player who won the bid, or you can choose to pay them that same price and take the card that they just won. So as the auctioneer, you get to choose between the two. It's just such an interesting mechanic. I love it.
And it's so fun when, you know, because it's easy to forget that when you're across from the auctioneer and you're bidding against other players and you think, I have this. I got it on the cheap. And the auctioneer says, oh, no, you didn't. I'm going to buy it.
Right.
So that's, oh, that's so fun.
So, this is a great game. I love it.
Well, the first one I'll bring out is one that I expect we're going to argue a little bit about, which is Splendor.
Okay.
Now, I say that because I know that Andrew really favors a similar game called...
Century Spice Road.
Yes.
It is on my list.
And Century Spice Road didn't make this list for one reason. Splendor, I've played so much Splendor, and maybe it's just because I've played it so much, it's just... But the rules are inherently easier because you don't have the little mechanic of trading things up for other things, up for other things.
Right.
And... when I played Century Spice Road, even with new players, I just got tired of having to explain that and thinking, why didn't I just play Splendor?
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of really gives you the same experience, and is it really necessary to do a lot of trading up to the piece instead of just sort of competing for the cards that are out there by picking up the jewels in the first place or beefing up your discounts? So, I don't know. For me, Splendor, it's just so easy. I just tell people, look, you just have these four actions you can do in that set. You just explain them one after the other, and their eyes light up. They go, oh, yeah, I get it, and boom, you're off and going. And it's a game that has a reasonable number of choices, but if you ask me, can I remember a particular glorious moment in Splendor, I sure don't.
Right.
It's
right.
just, it's a fun game that's not terribly memorable.
Right.
So.
Well, I'll just draft on you and go to Century Spice Road. That's also on my list.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, you know, I didn't get on the Splendor hype train when it came out in 2014. I wasn't gaming at the time, so I kind of missed the boat on it. I didn't play Splendor till after I'd played Century Spice Road. And it's interesting because I find the engine building in Century a whole lot more intuitive than the Splendor engine building because it takes apart your goal and your cards in a way, if that makes sense. So in Splendor, your engine building is within your cards, but in Century, your cards are a means to the higher spices. So I found the chain of spices actually a pretty good concept for people to latch onto. I mean, I taught my grandma this game, and she loved it. She tied me for first, actually. I've never had a more wounded pride. I love you, Grandma. but yeah, I don't know. Splendor just didn't do it for me. I kind of like the... Well, this is going to sound really dumb, but I kind of like the theme better in Century. And I know there's nothing there, but the art is really pretty. The bowls are cool.
Yeah.
I just, you kind of have that same tactile experience as people love with the poker chips in Splendor. And I think that's important for an entry-level game. Plus, I'm really excited by the fact that they're apparently coming out with two more games in this series, which are not expansions, but standalone games, which are that same entry-level, easy quality, and yet you can integrate the three for a more complex game altogether. That's really interesting to me because that could be the best of both worlds, where my gateway game is Century by itself or Eastern Wonders by itself, but then I've actually got a gamer's game there too that I can play with, you know, more experienced gamers by mushing them all together. So I'm going to be watching that. It's going to be interesting.
One thing I think is interesting that you said about your grandmother winning her first game against you, that is something about Splendor and Century both, is that it is possible for a player to win this their first time around.
Yeah.
I've seen it happen. So, and it's not purely out of the luck involved, because there is some luck, but it's just that easy to wrap your mind around. So it's kind of nice to play a game like that that levels the playing field.
Right.
Next on my list, so this is my number two, is Lords of Waterdeep. Or the Dungeons & Dragons Lords of Waterdeep. If you want to see kind of an interesting written review of this, you can see my Board Game Greek review on this on Board Game Geek. But I actually was... It's kind of funny because this is back earlier in my gaming. I was looking at Castle Ravenloft, and accidentally, I set it aside in my mind to order it. And then later on in the week, I went back and I ordered Lords of Waterdeep thinking I was ordering Castle Ravenloft.
Okay.
When it came, I was utterly shocked that I was playing a themeless kind of worker placement game. But it was my first worker placement game, and it got me hooked onto the genre.
Right.
And I have to say, as themeless as it is, it's really kind of fun.
It is,
It's... You can't take it too seriously because sometimes your choices get waylaid by you know, the other player drawing really good quests or completing a plot quest at the beginning. It just totally blows you away. You get an intrigue card for every time you, you know, render orange or something. But it is just a very accessible, easy game to play. This is a great game to introduce people to the hobby. So, yeah, that's, for me, Lords of Waterdeep.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoy Lords of Waterdeep. I don't own it. I've actually only played it once. But I can see the appeal there. It's definitely a good intro to the worker placement genre. My next pick would actually be a similar intro game. Sushi Go Party is my ideal drafting game.
Oh.
Even more than Seven Wonders, because it is just so simple. You can be up and running in 5 minutes. And I love that. I've never had it fall flat, and I can explain it like that. It's such a reliable experience for me. If someone comes to my game night who has never played a game, a modern board game before, Sushi Go Party will without fail be the first game I pull out.
Listeners, you should listen to Andrew on this one and not me. I think that if I were to create a list, if we were to do a list of, look, the game is great, I'm just burnt out on it, okay, this would be on that list for me.
Okay.
I just have played so much Sushi Go. Although it's probably less than you've played it.
Yeah, I've played it a lot. I just don't get sick of this one.
I just, for me, it's just kind of like, oh, another round of this. But you are right. It is a very accessible, very fun game, and it is a crowd pleaser.
Right.
So the next one on my list is one that I don't expect to be on yours at all.
Okay.
King of Tokyo.
Oh, man. Okay.
I almost want to qualify this and say with the right crowd.
Okay.
If you're in a party where there are a lot of people milling around, and you pull this game out and people are kind of in a real Ameritrash sort of mood where let's roll dice, let's kill each other. This can be a really fun game. I don't like the player elimination. I don't like that sometimes the turns can take too long. Mm-hmm. But, oh, you can be the mecha dragon or that killer rabbit guy or the, you know, there's so many cool characters that you can be. And what's even more fun is once you introduce the base game and then you introduce the power-up expansion, then it becomes meaty enough to please the hardcore gamer, I think, as well as the novice gamer.
No, this is a pick I can't quarrel with. I just do not like this game. And I guess you could say that this game is successful at events where gaming is not the main focus.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's fair, that it has that walk-up quality to it?
Right.
And if you die, you know, you just go eat some dip, you know, no problem.
Right.
And that's fine. That's
or go chat specific with some of your friends sitting on the couch or something like that. Exactly.
You know, that's a niche. It just doesn't jive exactly with the type of gaming I do, because I'm usually, even if it's casual gamers, they're usually at my house for a game night and we're looking for something a little more meaty than that.
Right.
And I realize I say that having just picked Sushi Go, but...
Well, you know, I'm still trying to get Andrew to try Gekido Bot Battles with me. One of the most overlooked games in that genre, I think. But it is overproduced, but deliciously overproduced. Cool minis. But I think the pricing killed that game. Anyway, getting off topic here.
Well, I'm back to the obscure here. This is a Kickstarter game, which I've heard absolutely nothing about. I don't think you've played it. I love this game. It's rather polarizing, and here's why. The game is called Vi, the card game of capture and control. And this is a tiny box game. I've never heard any buzz about it, but I describe it as small world in 10 minutes because it's a card-driven area control game where you are playing cards out of your hand, and there's one symbol on the card, and there are four cards of each symbol in the deck. And so when you play a card, you get to place your token on it, and you control that card. And if you play the second card of that group, or if someone else plays the second card of that group, they then control all the cards in that group. So you can kind of swing big chunks of land back and forth between people. And the goal of what you're trying to do is get your biggest contiguous group as your score. And I love it because there's this blocking, there's cutting off, you can cut someone's kingdom in half. It's just a really satisfying area control.
Is this that one with that, I think you showed this to me, is this that one with almost like the domino size cards? They're like really small, or no?
No, they're not really small. I actually did the free print and play. I don't know what the full cards look like. And they actually came out with a second edition that has player powers and adds some complexity, adds a fifth player. Man, I love this just as it is. The thing that sells it for me is if you were just playing these cards from your hand and trying to control areas, that would be a fine, though luck-swingy game, you mm-hmm. know, depending on what you get, if you get the right groups, you know, to control on the board. But what sells the game for me is these four nobles that are in front of you, your king, your queen, your jack, and your advisor. And each one of these has a special ability. The advisor, for example, can take over every adjacent card to it, orthogonally and diagonally. The king is orthogonal only. The queen is diagonal only. The jack is any one card of the eight surrounding it. So these give you the positioning and strategy that you need to really disrupt your opponents. I mean, you could take over up to eight cards from someone else by playing your advisor at the right time. And it's just such a neat little mechanic.
How long does the game last? 10?
10, 15 minutes.
10, 15 minutes?
It's short. And so that, to me, mitigates the luck. There's strategy to it. But there's luck, it's breezy, it's fun, it's over in 15 minutes.
So for our listeners interested, is it still available, print and play?
It's still available. The print and play has some watermarks on it. You can get it from the publisher's site. I do not remember the publisher. I think it's like $20. It's worth it. Honestly, I've thought about getting the Kickstarted version just because I really enjoy the game. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it can be polarizing, but that's just because of area control in general, I think. I think that people who are conflict averse won't find the game fun. But if you have a group that likes Small World or likes any sort of area control game, this is a great area control filler. And I don't see many of those. So it's definitely a good pick.
Hmm. Next on my list. Well, I'll just say it. Let's both get it over with. Seven Wonders. There we go. Yeah, it is. You know, I'll criticize Seven Wonders a little bit for its iconography. It can be a little hard to teach, like, absolute beginners. And for some reason, the concept that some people, and I had trouble grasping this at first, although it was much earlier in my gaming hobby, was the idea of production being, you don't, like, produce things and get, like, cubes you can stack next to you and spend. Yeah. It's sort of like produce just once every turn. Oh, but wait, the guy next to me can trigger it also. So
it's production capacity, and that's hard to wrap your head around.
Right. But once you kind of get that, it's a pretty easy game to grasp. And this is one of those that usually the first game it's a little bit shaky, and then everybody goes, ooh, let's do that again.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, only 20 minutes. Everybody plays at once these big, beautiful, artistic cards.
Right.
Really interesting theme. And actually, the themes kind of, if you look at the wonders, they're kind of themed a little bit according to, you know, their history so of the civilization. So, yeah, Seven Wonders. Now, that was a crossover.
It was a crossover.
You get to pull one off of your reserve.
Okay. Well, okay. I have a note here. Seven Wonders. If picked, surface Tokaido. So I'm going to do that.
Does that have to surface?
Oh man, you can't talk bad about Tokaido. Oh,
all right.
This is another Antoine Bauza game. It's breezy, but there is strategy there.
Back to back Bauza, and I just can't buy it.
Here's the thing. Tokaido will never be a deeply strategic game, and I'm utterly uninterested in the expansions because of that. I don't think you can make a gamer's game out of it. It is a gateway game by its nature, but it's very accessible, it's very easy to teach, and it has enough strategy in it that I really enjoy it. So one criticism that is leveled against this game is, well, you just pick the next available spot, and that's always your best thing because it maximizes your available moves, and this game just plays itself. Okay, if you're playing like that, I will beat you. I will beat you because there's more strategy to it than that. And there's a little bit of nuance to watching what people are up to, watching what they're likely to do next. And the key to me is knowing when you can get away with jumping ahead far to a good spot. Mm-hmm. Maybe that blocks someone, or maybe that just gives you something that's so good that you are willing to sacrifice the three or four spaces in between where you are and where you want to go. So I love this game. I play it strategically. You can also play it just to relax and have a good 20 minutes. So I think it's a great pick for a mix of competitive and casual gamers. I really like it. Tokaido by Antoine Bauza.
Well, so that was my number four and your number four. So we are on...
That was my five.
Oh, that was your five?
Yep.
Okay, so I have one more. You know, I was going to put this in my... We're going to do in a moment first impressions, but I think I've played this enough now that it goes beyond first impression. Deception, Murder in Hong Kong. Now, this is going to be a very interesting... One of the more, I think, most interesting podcast episodes we will ever do is one where both Andrew and I discuss social deduction games, because neither of us are big fans of social deduction. Am I right on that?
Yeah, in fact, I'll give you an advanced peek into my commentary.
Oh, it's not that bad. See, Deception Murder in Hong Kong, what it does is it makes mafia available to people who don't want to sit there and accuse their neighbor and say, oh, you've got shifty eyes, and da 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 da. Right. It gives you just enough information. You know, it's a combination of mafia and code names. Kind of. It is just a word suggestion game, right? And so you the person giving clues points to words that give hints to the murder weapon and clue that's in front of each player.
Right.
And then the players start looking and trying to figure out which clues go with which player. And there's a lot of misdirection because the clues aren't very strong. They kind of only hint, sort of like Mysterium does.
Right.
So, yeah, I can't say that any one game of this is incredibly memorable, but it's so easy to teach. And I have taught people that look at my collection, friends and relatives who come over, look at my collection and say, I could never play a game, any of these games. Where's Monopoly? Where's Clue?
Right.
And so you say, ah, speaking of Clue, you know, I think you might like this one. I would say I can look at Deception and think of, 10 ways to improve this game. One criticism or level against it is in all of our plays, the murderer almost always gets found out.
Right.
And so it does seem to be a little on the easy side, but it's just super accessible. And we've had a lot of fun with it this last month.
Yeah, I would say I can't argue with this one, but I can actually. I have two. I'm going to make this a pick seven. We're going to rewrite the rules.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, so here's my take. Just hear me out. If you like the accusation and deduction part of Deception Murder in Hong Kong, I would recommend Mafia de Cuba, which maximizes and ramps up that conversation between players. I absolutely love that game. That would probably be my number one pick for social deduction games. If you like the clue giving and the collaborative aspect of Deception Murder in Hong Kong, I would highly recommend Mysterium, which takes that same murder mystery idea, except it makes it cooperative, so there is no murderer, but you guys are trying to communicate with this ghost through weird, almost Dixit-esque cards that are meant to nudge you towards the true murderer, the true murder location, and the true murder weapon. So Deception's all right, but I would definitely pick other games before it.
You know what? You've gone beyond the pick five.
Yes.
And that could give me the right to abuse the rules too, but I'm going to be the bigger gamer. No comment about my weight. We're going to end this right here.
Okay.
Those are very good points. And I think in your groups, those kinds of social deduction games work better.
Right.
I think for me, I mean, I'm talking about introducing social. This is like the first social deduction game
right.
they've ever played.
Right.
And they're pretty timid people. And they would be actually intimidated by Mafia.
Yeah. And in light of the accessibility, I can't argue with Deception.
Yeah. But Mafia de Cuba, we have to do another episode
okay.
on social deduction games.
Again, I've given you my hot take on social deduction games. So you have been informed, oh internets.
So, first impressions. That was out of the blue.
Man, I destroy the guitar and now he goes to this.
I actually didn't have a good vocal warm-up. First impression. You can edit this out if you wanted to.
I probably will.
That's really not that good.
Probably best.
All right, so first impressions. Yeah, let's just talk about some games we played lately. This is the real deal. We're not making this up. This is stuff that we just had one or two quick plays of lately. So, yeah, I was over at a friend's house, and despite my massive game collection and the fact that this person only had one game that was purchased for them, it happened to be a game that wasn't in my collection, which was really cool.
He said,
hey, you know, my son's just bought me this game, Mystic Veil. And so I played that game, and wow, I was really kind of impressed. Now, I'm more likely to be impressed by another whiz-bang deck builder than you are,
right.
I know.
Yeah.
But this game did two things that were really cool. And I know anybody who knows anything about Mystic Veil is going to know the first one. The fact that you take that sleeve and you're buying like little inserts, these transparent inserts.
That is really cool.
Slip down into there.
That's really cool.
It is, but it kind of makes me wonder about the longevity of the game. It's like... I don't tend to think, Andrew and I tend to think differently. Like, I want a game that's going to be in my collection forever and that I'll get hundreds of plays out of. Andrew's more, I think, realistic to say that you're only going to get a few dozen before a dozen or so before you move the game on. So it's probably worth the money, even if all you're going to get is 20 to 30 plays out of it, which I imagine it's more durable than that.
Right.
But still, that was the one thing, this idea that you're building the card as you go along. But the other thing that it did really well, it had this really cool push your luck mechanic, so that at the end of your turn, while the other person's taking their turn, you sort of get to draw as many cards as you want and put them out. But once you hit the fourth, what was that called? Decay token. And some of the cards have this decay token on them. And you get like six decay, I think, at the beginning of the game. And then some of the cards that do like really powerful things also have a decay token on it, right? So there's that trade-off. So you kind of push your luck, and whatever you're able to get out before you go over the amount of decay token is what you get to play that next turn. If you go over the amount, then you lose all of those cards, but you do get one mana to start your following turn with. So it's kind of a little bit of a consolation prize, but not much. I did play it safe and won. I think I only pushed my luck once on this
one
and won the game. So it did make me wonder, but after one play, that you can't possibly judge.
Well, I was going to ask, so it sounds like it gives you something to do during someone else's turn, which is my main criticism with deck builders usually. Mm-hmm. But that was my question. Is it a valuable part of the game? Is it worthwhile? And if it is, I guess you have to worry about people cheating, depending on who you play with. But
yeah,
you're trusting them to react when they draw their fourth decay.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're playing with people who are going to be that petty and cheat, well. Yeah, so what have you played recently?
Okay, well, I'm once again going to supersize this and cram two into one.
Oh,
breaking all the rules. But that's because these two really hang close together in my mind. Mysterium, which I just mentioned, and Samurai Spirit, both of which I got for Christmas. And I've already played both of them about six or seven times. We've really taken advantage of the break. And it's interesting to me because they're both co-ops that are just so different. And yet I appreciate one thing about both of them, and that's that they play a high player count very well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've learned with Samurai Spirit, it actually fell kind of flat as a two-player. But man, play it with five or six, and all of a sudden you're supporting each other. You really, the theme just comes through so much better. And what's really a simple, almost push your luck card game really takes on something more. And I'm really impressed at how much game gets packed into that box. But if you're playing with a large group, and Mysterium again does the same thing, it can accommodate seven people, which is a rarity in a board game. And it does it really well.
It's co-op Dixit. And trust me on this one. If you used to love Dixit, but you got burnt out because you played it too much and everybody was requesting it, and it's like, now you don't want to see a Dixit card again, try Mysterium. For me, it breathed new life into that game.
Yeah.
I only bring out Dixit because it's such a crowd pleaser, but I personally am tired of playing it. But when I played it as Mysterium, oh my goodness, that was
now,
so cool.
I love Dixit. It's still my 10th best game of all time. But one thing we've done is we've started playing Mysterium with Dixit cards, and that's really interesting.
Oh, you see, you've done it.
Yeah, it works really well.
Wow.
Because even in four or five plays, you know, we had already found some of the same cards in Mysterium. It's like, oh, there's that weird guy, Dr. Hat in the train. What do you do with that card?
Mm-hmm.
Not a thing. It's useless. So playing with Dixit cards doesn't make the game more or less challenging. It just makes it interesting. And from what I've seen, the expansion just does that. It gives you more locations, more people, and more clue cards, which that's interesting, you know?
So this one I played three times, and I'm still calling it a first impression game because I haven't merged in the expansions yet. And it is still very much a first impression after three plays. Arctic Scavengers. Yes, I'm bringing up another deck builder.
Okay.
But
you have my permission.
Goodness. Yeah, thank you very much. You want to sing the deck building song? I wrote one.
There is no deck building song.
He thinks there's no deck building song. I'm going to polish it up and play it for you guys next week.
Okay, fair enough.
So, Arctic Scavengers. I think Arctic Scavengers needs to be remembered as a game that early on did something really unique with deck building.
Yeah.
Because I was telling Andrew, one of the key things about deck building is that, okay, it follows the same kind of core mechanic for most of deck builders. And there is always luck of the draw. But it's what a deck builder does with that luck of a draw that I think separates the great ones from the mediocre. And this is a great one because of what it allows you to do. You get a good fighting draw, well, then you're going to be fighting for the contested resource.
Right.
You get a good scavenging draw, well, that's what you're going to use it for.
Right.
Or you get a good dig draw, then you're going to do some digging. And then maybe if the guy next to you hasn't put a lot toward that contested resource, then maybe you'll keep a couple of those fight cards behind. Or maybe if you just happen to have two really powerful fight cards, you'll bluff kind of and say, well, that's all I can really play. But in reality, you're planning on taking that contested resource. Right. And that bluffing element, too.
Right. No, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That just adds so much to that game. You never feel like, I mean, sometimes you do, but for the most part, you don't just get stuck. Right. With a throwaway hand in Arctic Scavengers, not if you're playing it right. And I can't wait to try it now with the expansions, with the sort of the various tribal leaders, right, and other things. So
no, I'll actually join you in singing the praises of this one. I really liked it, which is rare for me in a deck builder. You know, we kind of have a fraught relationship. But I think what it is for me is that contested resources pile, because you're just, that forces you to butt up against everyone else, because that's where the point cards are. You can go a full market strategy and buy a lot of cards and kind of skirt the contested resources. But in practice, that will put you up against the other players. And I really like that.
Yeah.
Although, unlike you, I don't feel a desire to dig into the expansions yet. I'm really happy with the base game. I'm maybe mix in one new card to play or something. But
yeah,
I like the base game. It's good. It's really good. It's tight and snappy. I like that.
We could do another topic on this, but I have a bad habit of... Not a bad habit. A habit of, when a game comes with the expansion, I just will not play the expansion first, because I've had expansions ruin games.
Yeah.
And I just, I don't want that to happen and for me to get a bad impression of the core game. But yeah, the core game is beautiful.
Right.
Any other first impressions on your list?
Well, actually, this one's not on my list, but I'm going to improvise. I'm going to circle back to Dixit, because I just haven't given this game enough airtime. So my wife and I were in an interesting situation this week. We had lent out our game of Codenames Duet, which is our preferred two-player game.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really feeling down. She really wanted to play it. Didn't feel up for any of our more intense, you know, co-ops like Escape or Samurai Spirit.
Oh, you did that thing you were talking about doing.
We did that thing we were talking about doing. We got the Codenames app on our phone. So, and they have a duet app now, so you can see the reverse of the card and play Duet. And we played it with Dixit cards. And let me tell you, that was the most interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm just on a kick lately with Mysterium Dixit, with this clue-giving concept.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, did that work my brain in a really interesting way. Especially playing it duet. It was just such an odd way to see these Dixit cards that, of course, we've played dozens of times.
Right.
And now all of a sudden we're trying to give hints for them. Now, we did have to bend the rules a little bit. Obviously, Codenames one word hints would not be sufficient,
right?
So we kind of just played it loose. We kind of just played it honor code. We said anything that would be appropriate as a Dixit hint would be appropriate.
Well, I could see
which
that
makes sense.
That's,
you know,
works
that way. You can't say, you know, two guys sitting on a park bench and also a dragon for two, you know, because that would be way too specific in Dixit. So it's way too specific in I don't know what we call it, if it's Dixit Duet or Codenames Dixit. But yeah, we really enjoyed it, and we'll probably be trying it again. So hey, Czech Games or Liebelud, if you're listening, we should talk. Okay, well, one other game that we've been playing together, actually, that I'd like to talk about is Grimslingers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which this game, you know, is anyone talking about this game right now?
Not nearly enough. Have we discussed this in one of our other podcasts?
No, we haven't talked about this
okay.
at all.
Let me just say, first of all, if you like Doomtown, just go drop the money on Grimslingers. My goodness, it costs about as much as one Doomtown Reloaded expansion. Well, not that now that they're out of print and on clearance. But if you like that weird West world, buy Grimslingers. Support is it's not green, yeah, it's Greenbrier
Games,
yeah, support Greenbrier Games. And I saw this game when it first came out, not at the last Gen Con, the Gen Con before, and I tell you, so much love went into this game.
Yeah,
there and you talk about game designers who are real fans of this universe. It's just dripping with theme. It sucks you into the story. It's like a really, really cool choose your adventure book with a fun battle mechanism built
right.
in. It's
right.
just, oh, well, yeah. And so I'm gushing, but you talk
right.
a little bit about the mechanic, because I know you have some interesting things to say about like the duel experience versus the campaign.
Well, the first thing I'll say is this game works even if you're not a Doomtown fan. I've never played Doomtown in my life,
mm-hmm.
and I really like this game. The art just draws you in. It's very evocative, very thematic. And actually, I was really bummed when we first played this game, because we started out by playing the competitive dual mode that comes in the box. And I understand why they have you start with that, because it teaches you the mechanics of the game. But when you play it competitively, it's a kind of fiddly, annoying game with some rules hiccups, and it's a little swingy who wins, and you're just kind of frustrated and blah. So I was kind of disappointed the first couple times we played this, because I thought, yeah, this is not going to live up to the beautiful art inside. Well, then we started this story, and the story is well written, but the whole thing that changes it for me is the shift from competitive gameplay to cooperative gameplay. All of a sudden, those duels take on a new nature. And let me tell you, the beasts in this game are tough. I mean, I remember a game where you, me, and Evan were playing, and this jackalope comes out of nowhere, and he just eviscerates us.
I'll show my age here. It was almost like the Monty Python moment.
Right.
And the Holy Grail.
Right.
Where it's like, what horrible thing? What, behind the rabbit? That's it. Go on, boys. Chop its head off. And the jackalope just tears us to shreds.
Oh, man. It was tough. And this is a tough co-op. And we were going through the campaign, and we felt like we were just scraping by. And the story was good. And we had some Western music going. Man, this is a great way to spend 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah. Go to your favorite, you know, YouTube music source and listen to some good Western music while you're playing this game. It's a lot of fun. Now, I wonder if we were to go back to the dual mode now that we've done the campaign.
Yeah, I wonder.
Would
that
it be
too.
As fun? I mean, would it be more fun anyway?
Right. I wondered if maybe my hesitation was just getting to know the mechanics. But no, I really think that the fiddliness is there. I think it's inherent in the game design, and that's okay. Because when you're all working together, I really do think the feel is different. I don't think I really have a desire to play this competitively.
We at Get On Board do not normally tell our audience what to say and what not to say, but we will not permit you to complain about the fact that once you play this campaign, the game is over and you've just sort of wasted the game. Sorry, but in an era of legacy games, and for its price, oh my goodness. I mean, this is like the best 20, what is it, $25 or whatever that you'll spend on a co-op adventure.
And we're about halfway through this one. I'd play it again. I've got a group of three guys that we're meeting on Tuesday nights. I'm hoping to bring this one out. I'm hoping to play through the campaign with them. There's an expansion coming. The Kickstarter just ran. Didn't jump in on the Kickstarter. I'm really kicking myself.
And it would be so easy, and I can imagine. I've heard, but I haven't gone out and looked, so I should be careful here. But I do believe that there are a number of fans who've made expansions for this already, or just made their own scenarios. Even if you replay the scenarios, the chances of the same monsters coming up with the same abilities and in the exact same way against you are pretty low.
Right.
So there's a lot of variability, even if you wanted to replay it.
Yeah, I actually even found it enjoyable playing it solo, just as a one-off. Just pick a random monster, pick some random attributes, and go to town, give myself kind of an appropriate level to tackle it. I got destroyed, but it was fun. You know, I enjoy it.
You know, I actually had another game in my first impressions list, but I think we just ended with that little, you know, piece of chocolate that just topped off dinner perfectly. Grimslingers. That was like the perfect first impression.
We'll save the liver and onions for next week.
That's right. It's not liver and onions, but
it's a good steak.
El Grande is not. Oh, oops, I gave it away. Okay, so
tune in next week.
Well, hey, it's been great going through that pick five of accessible games, sharing some first impressions with you. Please let us know your opinions. You can find our contact info wherever you're listening to this podcast. I'm Tim.
I'm Andrew, and you've been listening to Get On Board. You can find us on the web at www.getonboard.games, on iTunes, and on BoardGameGeek.
Goodbye.